I'm afraid to go home. So, holy man, the burning question is, can I maintain these peaceful feelings, or will the torment start up again upon my return?
Tell me what you have learnt.
Well, I guess I've learned that trust brings peace.
Good. So, what if you go home and trust her, and she betrays you?
Oh, well, that would be horribly painful. Maybe it would kill me. But still, I won't have driven her to it, and we will have had a time of peace. I can't help it if she betrays me. It will be up to her. I can control myself, but I can't control her. That is something else I've learned.
Wonderful. Oh, and there's one more thing you've learned, which will make all the difference in carrying out your new program.
Which is?
It's about how you are going to treat her. Yes. I can see you smiling as you think about that.
Yes, I remember. I'm going to treat her with honour and kindliness, as an equal, and listen to what she says and believe her, just as I would treat you.
One day, five pilgrims who had become friends in the line sat around their campfire talking. Liv was a woman in her early 60s from Scandinavia, a maternal and successful woman to whom the others were naturally drawn.
When I send my grandchildren gifts, they don't write me thank you notes.
I know that situation. There's nothing new about that old problem.
It makes me so sad. That's why I've come to see the holy man, to ask him what to do.
What?
But Liv, honey, that's the sort of question in our country we write to an advice column about. We don't spend all this time and money coming to see the holy man, who in any case, I can assure you, is into much deeper matters.
You might as well ask him how to get children to pick up their clothes.
No, I'm behind you all the way, Liv. This is a question that has baffled Western civilization.
Well, I think I can tell you what the holy man will say. The answer is that you are bringing this suffering upon yourself, and in order to relieve yourself of it, you can do one of two things. You can stop sending them presents, or you can just be happy with the giving and not expect or hope for a thank you note. The idea being that if you don't hope, you won't be disappointed.
Well, sometimes I have stopped sending presents for a while, but I have more money than they do, and they need the clothes and the fun things they wouldn't have otherwise. I'm sure you're right about the hoping. Mm-hmm. I think I have taught myself not to expect the letters, but I still feel so hurt when I don't get them.
Oh, I sacrificed a great deal and went without to send my son to college. It cost me $80,000. He never thanked me.
Well, most kids take it for granted that you'll pay for their education, like it's part of their birthright.
Mm-hmm. Maybe grandchildren think the same way. They expect ongoing presents from their grandma. It's a given, a part of life.
Do you talk to them on the phone, Liv?
Sometimes I call them to ask if they got the presents, and they thank me and say they really like them. But I want them to tell me without my calling to ask. I want them to write to me on their own.
I don't see why you didn't spend this money going to see them instead of the holy man. That way, they could get to know you.
Except for this year. I have gone every summer to spend a month with them. I have my own business, so I'm able to take the time. I stay at a nearby inn because my daughter-in-law is not so fond of me and I don't feel comfortable in her house. My son is not a perfect husband to her and she blames me. She says I spoiled him and now I am spoiling the grandchildren. I always have a good visit with the children and when I go away, I am sure they will write me thank you notes when I next send them presents. But they never do.
My daughter lives 2,000 miles from me. I used to send her money for her college education. She never wrote to me unless I was a little late with the money. After a couple of years, I began to be suspicious. I investigated and found out she wasn't going to college. She was living with a man and supporting him.
What a betrayal.
My son died.
It was a freak accident. He was running and he jumped over a fence and misjudged. He caught his foot and landed flat, hitting his head on a rock.
Oh, oh no.
He was in a coma for a long time. And then he died. My darling boy.
Oh, no.
She wiped away tears, and the others did too. By now, a lot of people had joined their circle around the fire, and two others offered stories of losing their children, one to suicide, another to drugs. Liv's problem grew more and more insignificant in the light of these tragedies.
But not to me. I know that over the next few days, people were laughing at me. The woman who had come to ask the holy man how to get her grandchildren to write thank you notes to her.
Do you think that if they wrote to you, it would prove that they love you?
Yes. I guess that's it. It would prove that I was in their minds, that I had some reality in their life. I feel so alone. My husband is dead. In not so many years, I will follow him. I want them to remember me. But how can they if they don't even remember me when I am alive?
Ah, yes, I see. It's a sorry situation, all right. I don't really have an answer for you, but I tend to look on the bright side of life. Maybe they will miss you this summer, be so disappointed you didn't come visit that everything will change.
Yes, that's what I was hoping, but I didn't dare admit it to myself. Maybe right now they are wishing with all their hearts that I was with them and vowing to do differently concerning me, vowing to show their appreciation.
Let's hope so.
But in my heart of hearts, I'm worried that they don't care, or worse, won't notice, that their grandmother hasn't come to see them this summer.
2 days later, she was able to lay out her trouble to the holy man, detaining him at the back door after he told her who he was, grasping his sleeve and not letting go until she had emptied her heart.
Oh, this is egotism. You are suffering from an advanced case of egotism. I can tell you right now that if they each wrote you 10 pages a week, you wouldn't be satisfied. You'd still feel wronged and unappreciated and... well, you'd probably want 20 pages. How can those children love you until you are able to love them selflessly, unconditionally? Goodbye.
The door closed behind her, and she started down the mountain path, the long, lonely path, so conducive to reflection.
Very idea. Who does he think he is? For goodness sake. He's obviously never had ungrateful children to deal with, living his rarefied life as he does. What does he know about giving, 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 and getting no return?
Then she thought of how he gave of himself every day of his life. And there was no donation box, no plate being passed, no beautifully printed, carefully worded requests for money in the mail. He had not written any books for them to buy, nor were there any relics. Holy man pictures, splinters of hermitage, chips of surrounding boulders, small bottles of holy man spring water.
As I walked down the mountain path, I felt myself blushing. I remembered him saying that if the grandchildren wrote 10 pages to me, I would expect 20. Then I began to think of the times that I had received certain scrawls and scribbles from the grandchildren over the years. I realized I'd always discounted them. I used to think that their mother or father had made them write to me. Was that what he meant by never being satisfied? But my goodness, isn't it natural for a mother or grandma to want to be loved and appreciated? I really do not in the least see what's so egotistical about that.
She remembered all the times, hundreds of times over the years, she had said to her grandchildren, "Do you love your grandma?" But she could not remember saying, "I love you," to them.
I sat down on a rock and looked at the view, and I felt my heart lift, and a sense of freedom came over me as I thought about the new life I might enjoy.
She heard footsteps, and, looking back, saw that her women friends, having waited for each other, were hurrying down the path after her.
Oh, we are dying to know what the holy man told you.
I felt so ashamed I couldn't reply. I couldn't speak. It felt as if I was admitting I had a horrible disease. I tried to get some words out.
Well,
what? What did he say?
He said I was a terrible egotist.
They fell silent, as shocked by Joe's answer as they had originally been by her question. But they were reluctant to sympathize. The holy man must know the truth of the matter. They began to feel somehow impressed, as if she'd been favored. He must have really cared to tell her such a thing, to not pull his punches.
Nevertheless, you are a holy person.
Me? No.
Yes, you, Liv. Now that he has told you that you are an egotist, you don't need to be one anymore. You could be holy, as we all are. If we treat everyone as a holy person, we will be happy. He told us so.
Is that so? How long will it take?
It's instant. I feel that I'm a holy person right now, and that you are too. And that is that. It's that simple. He said it was so, and it is so. Let's not make a big deal out of it. I'm just so excited at the idea of treating everyone as a holy person that I can't wait to get going. Already I feel so much happier. And you look happier too, Liv.
Give us a hug.
Liv felt lighthearted going down the path with her friends.
I think this is going to be fun, this not being egotistical. I realize I haven't felt like this since I was a child. Maybe there is a new life beginning, one that's full of possibilities. I'll be forgiving to my grandchildren, to everyone, and be a nobler person all around, a person people would look up to as they did to the holy man. Look up to and learn from.
Unfortunately, Liv began to feel rather important in her new role as holy person. She held her head high, trying out a benign smile, wishing she had a mirror.
Wait for me. What did he say to you? What's the answer to the celebrated thank you note question?
Egotism.
Yes.
Oh, I see. Yes, well, of course children are bound to be egotistical. It's the nature of being a child. They're busy with their friends and their games and their worries. Kids have worries too. It's not easy being a kid. Or an adult either. I don't know which is hardest, but you need a good, healthy ego in this world to look out for yourself, I'll tell you that.
Isn't that the truth? You're a man of real understanding.
But you're confused, I think. You see, egotism is the sickness of an unhealthy ego. The holy man was referring to Liv's ego, not the grandchildren's.
Surely not. Tell me what he said.
Liv found that she did not want to repeat the holy man's words. He had hurt her feelings, and now this nice man was repairing them. He was on her side. Liv and he walked ahead on the trail, enjoying their rapport.
I could kill her. How do you treat someone like a holy person when they're acting like a complete fool? When they just don't get it?
Oh, maybe with Liv the message will seep in after a while. She just hasn't really thought about it. And her new boyfriend is a bad influence.
But if we're going to have trouble treating a nice woman like Liv as if she were holy, how will we do with mean people? With cheats and liars and racists?
Maybe people like that have never been treated kindly and courteously before. Maybe when we're nice, they'll be nice back.
And if they're not, we just don't let it bother us, because we have nothing riding on it. I think that's the secret. Not to be invested in their behavior. Not to get exasperated and want to kill them.
It will be easy. What's hard about just being decent to everyone? Liv got it for a minute there, then she lost it. But it will come back.
What do you do with a man, like that friend of hers, who just says what everyone wants to hear?
The idea is not to judge him or anybody. We have to give up getting mad at people for how they think or act. Give up having prejudices about right and wrong.
We'll just be wimps then. Spineless. Not standing up for anything or against anything.
No. We will have peace of mind and the freedom of mind to see into the truth of things.
Joe sat in the kitchen watching Helena create lunch. This provided every bit as much pleasure as listening to Ho's cello, watching Daniel dance, talking to Maria, Ed, Henri, or Kim. Intuition in motion. Intelligence and discipline in motion. Every move from cupboards to chopping boards to cooker was efficient, graceful, present. And, at the end, something delicious to eat. Everyone was happy when it was Helena's day to cook. She was an African-American who had established a chain of cheap nutritional restaurants in poor areas that were also cooking schools. Eat right and learn how to cook it. The kitchen windows were open to the rock-strewn yard, and the boulder birds were flitting back and forth bringing food to their young, who were nestled in the crevices of the large standing monoliths which surrounded the hermitage. Kim was wrestling rocks from one spot to another, his way of increasing his upper body strength.
I'm not sure whether Kim is building something, demolishing something, or whether he's got anything in mind at all besides lifting, carrying, and placing. I like to hear him whistling, like he is today.
Suddenly, Joe felt his heart flopping around in his chest like a big beached fish. He took a heart pill from his robe pocket and drank it down with some water, being sure this action was out of Helena's view.
Getting dependent on my heart pills. I should tell the other monks about my heart trouble. They're already upset about me spending the winter alone. And anyway, I've already had to promise to get a cellular phone in case I'm in trouble. Meaning, if I was dying. But I can't imagine calling for help and getting them to send a helicopter. Oh, that'll be the day. How embarrassing. How ignoble. I'll never do that.
Helena, as if sensing his discomfort, some trouble in his mind or heart, came to the table and sat beside him on the bench. She put an arm around him, kissed his cheek.
It's so nice that everyone is so affectionate with me. Even the men give me hugs and kisses.
When Daniel came into the kitchen and saw them sitting so close and so contentedly, he felt jealous. It seemed to him that Joe preferred the other monks to him, that he shared intimate moments with them and not with him. He felt like a snake was inside him, coiling around his innards, squeezing, filling his throat with bile. He poured himself a cup of tea and stood with his back to them.
I understood what Daniel was feeling, but I realized that any gesture I made towards him could worsen the situation, that any acknowledgement would only embarrass him. I knew that he was feeling troubled. He seemed to be feeling resentment as well as jealousy, and I think resentment is one of the worst of the evils, worse than envy or hate or egotism, although all those feelings are similar. But resentment is insidious. It eats up your vitals. It alienates you from your comrades. You feel wronged, a victim, and you want to get even.
I'm getting too old to be a dancer. The honed instrument, the kinetic sculpture that is my body, is beginning to fail, and I can't any longer attain the standard set in my mind. I'm famous, but not as famous as I'd hoped. And now, clearly, I've reached the peak of my powers. And although these powers used to be more than adequate, they were not astonishing. All too soon, they won't even be adequate.
I wish there was a pill for the snake that's feeding on the bitterness in Daniel. Like my heart pill. That will hopefully calm this fluttering fish.
Helena returned to her cooking. Joe went to the window to observe Kim at his work, and Daniel joined him there. Kim, with a big rock in his arms, unable to see where he was going, was staggering around in circles, tipping precariously to one side. He walked smack into one of the standing monoliths, rebounded off it, dropped the rock he was carrying, and sat down hard on the ground, looking extremely surprised. Joe and Daniel burst out laughing together, vaporizing the creatures inside them, which were released on the gust of their laughter. Among the monks, there was a shirker. It was the poet, Ed. He showed up for chores late and left early. He always took the easiest job, grumbled while he worked, and did it in an unsatisfactory way, so it often had to be redone by one of the others. When it was his turn to go to town for supplies, he never made the trip in one day, but took 2 days, thereby missing 2 days of chores and having a night on the town as well. Mostly, he tried to get out of going to town.
I know it's my turn to go into town, but I've got a terrible headache. I'm sure I'm coming down with something. Anyway, it means I can't make the trip.
That evening, when the monks met in the common room, they discussed Ed's headache, trying and failing to be charitable. Helena believed Ed, but all the others were dubious about his illness.
He really is quite miserable. He's sick as a dog.
Which of us should take his place and go for supplies?
Let's wait him out. We can just eat rice and beans until he gets well. But why should we suffer just because he's playing sick? Why not go down the hill and get the fruit and vegetables, but not let the malingerer have any?
Oh, that's mean. If he's sick, he needs a proper diet. He needs vitamins and, you know...
If is the key word. Let's ask Joe what to do.
Good idea.
They sought out the holy man, who was sitting in his room thinking. He did not always join them in the evening, sometimes choosing not to break his silence. The bedrooms were on the second floor, simply furnished with a single bed, a bureau, a bookshelf, a closet, a wooden chair. Joe was sitting in his chair, and it somehow seemed to the monks a beautiful sight. Sometimes, when they had gone a day or even a few hours without seeing him, and came upon him unexpectedly, he took their breath away.
So, now you've told me the problem, I'll go and see Ed.
He went to Ed's room and sat at the end of his bed, looking at the poet, who lay with his eyes closed, but did not appear to be sleeping.
Water. This is a very sad case. A downed poet. A poet unable to contribute to the community any longer, or live in harmony with us. A poet who, in fact, is causing a schism in the community, breaking it into a pro-Ed camp and an anti-Ed camp. The pro-Ed camp being a very small camp indeed, by the way. I'm always careful to invite to my hermitage those persons I believe to have their feet upon the path. But it seems this time I've chosen a troublemaker, whose feet are, most of the time, upon the bed. I shall have to ask you to go.
What?
You heard me.
I can't go. I'm too sick. I think I'm dying.
And actually, I would rather die than be tossed out of the hermitage, where I've spent the happiest and most fruitful days of my life.
What a fool I've been to let my native laziness jeopardize my stay here.
I've never claimed to be a healer, but I think I will try it right now. It is possible that I can heal. I wouldn't be at all surprised. Poet, stand up and be well.
As Joe spoke the words, he simultaneously grabbed hold of the poet, dragged him from the bed, and stood him on his feet, giving him something very like a box on the ears.
Ow! Ah, that hurt! Oh,
it's worked! I am a healer!
You're right! I'm healed!
Oh, you look like a new man!
I am! I feel wonderful! That's amazing! Joe, I am so much better mentally, emotionally, and physically that... I don't think you'll ever have trouble with me again. If you will please just give me one more chance, please.
Of course I will. But in return, I must ask you to tell no one of these fabulous healing capabilities I have discovered. I wouldn't want the world to think that I can just produce miracles.
One day, a man in his early 40s, with a very unhappy face, came to see me.
I have so many troubles, I don't know where to begin. Nothing goes right for me in my life. I continually find I am in abusive relationships. First with my father, then my wife, and since my divorce, with other friends and lovers. I know that I must seek out the wrong people, but how do I stop? Even understanding my problems, and God knows I've had plenty of therapy, I keep ending up with the wrong people in my life. This is also true in my job situation. Even my children ill-treat me. Even my dog.
And how do you feel about your height?
My height? I don't think about it. Height? My height is all right. Why?
Well, for those of us who are not born into an inescapable prison of poverty and disease, there is a world of choice open to us. I have reflected long upon this matter, and now I understand that the only thing we have no choice about in life is our height. That is the only thing that is a given. We get to complain about our height, and that's about all.
That would be a silly thing to complain about.
Yes, very silly, since we can't do anything about it. But not so silly as complaining about all the troubles in our life we can choose to change.
Joe talked to a middle-aged woman who was so impressive in her manner, character, and intelligence, it was hard to believe she had a care in the world. She had greeted him most graciously, and now they were seated on the bench by the door, where he was wont to talk to pilgrims when the occasion presented itself.
In the town where I live, I have an enemy who is step by step destroying my life. And please, I beg of you, don't tell me to turn my other cheek. I tried that at first, and she only proceeded to do me more and more harm.
I immediately thought about Jesus' words. Whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also.
This woman has told terrible lies about me. And as a result, I have lost my job, my husband has divorced me, many of my friends have abandoned me.
You don't look like a woman who has suffered such a nightmare.
Because I have had a chance to be away from the plague of her. I've been healed among your pilgrims on this lovely mountain. But being away from home is not a solution. I will not be driven by this vermin from my own town, the town I have lived in all my life and love so much. Holy man, I am not a perfect woman by a long shot. I have many flaws. But I swear that the stories she tells about me are lies. She's even taken me to court, sued me, and won.
I thought of other verses from the Bible. And if any man will sue thee at the court and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. I tried to imagine how I would feel if someone sued me for my two extra robes. Would I follow Christ's noble injunction? I hadn't done such a good job of giving up my robe to the famous man. Love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Pray for them which despitefully use you. This certainly was his hardest command. But in any case, this woman has forbidden me to draw upon Jesus' counsel regarding her persecution problem.
Do you think she will kill you?
No, I do not. That is the one thing she won't do.
Well, that's great. Socrates said of Anytus and Miletus, they can kill me, but they can't harm me. So?
Holy man, forgive me, but she has already harmed me incredibly, as I think you heard me tell you. Though you did seem to be thinking of other things.
Yes, but I see you as wonderfully unharmed. You're very well. You are free. You have discovered your true friends, have you not?
Well, yes, in a way I have.
And your life is stripped to its essence. It is pure gold. You are healthy, smart and strong. How lucky you are.
Really? Tell me.
I've just told you. Whereas this poor enemy of yours is either deluded in her mind about you, or has been deceived by others in regard to you, or is consumed by envy. Your enemy is not well, or healthy, or strong, and is unable to think straight, or see straight, because of her obsession with you.
Yes, but...
And so I urge you to be gentle in your thoughts about her. She doesn't know what she's doing. She can't help herself. She can't go on with her life as you can, as you have, as you're doing right now, growing and learning. You will no longer let this poor, weak creature have the power to upset you.
When you put it that way.
I see you as one who is already reconciled, and from this position of strength, you can easily be kind. So go forth and be so.
Yes. Yes, I will. You have convinced me. Have you noticed that what it all comes down to is pretty much turning the other cheek?
Yes, it does a little. I see what you mean. Well, I suppose there's almost no improving on the words of the master.
It was Maria's day to cook breakfast. Joe watched her, feeling bemused. Unlike Helena, who was always present, in the moment, Maria's mind was not on it. She was thinking of other things, a science experiment, no doubt, moving distractedly from one chore to the other, burning herself once, leaving the taps running twice, and three times bumping some part of her body, stifling exclamations. Gradually, the monks entered the kitchen and placed themselves at the long table, first taking bowls from the open shelves, or plates if they were having scrambled eggs and toast instead of cereal. When Henri, the lawyer, sat down, Joe realized that he always sat in the same place at the table. The others, consciously or otherwise, had learned to leave it available for him.
I looked at Henri, and I noticed for the first time the sleeves of his robe were each impeccably folded, three times, to leave his forearms free. Then I saw that he wasn't taking any food. He hadn't even selected a plate or a bowl. I realized that Henri was waiting for the blue plate that Helena was using. When she'd finished and had washed it, Henri went to get it for himself, then sat down again at his place, serving himself from the platter on the table, a portion of by now rather cold eggs. Henri was not always this particular.
The next morning, Joe sat down in Henri's place. When Henri came in and saw Joe there, he flushed, obviously upset. Joe was imperturbable and seemed to take no notice. The others did notice and were uneasy. Henri stood irresolute, paced a little, then took his blue plate and sat down elsewhere. That night, when they were free to talk, he sought out Joe.
Why did you sit down at my place at the table this morning? I feel that it was intentional.
For an answer, Joe seized Henri's thrice-folded sleeve and pulled it down. He walked away.
Maria, what's the matter with Joe?
He must think there is something the matter with you.
And the next morning, when Henri walked into the kitchen, I was standing there with the blue plate in my hands. I dropped it on the floor, and it broke. Everyone was astonished. I got the broom and dustpan, and I cleaned it up. That evening, Henri lay in wait for me and nabbed me when I came into the common room.
Okay, you think I've gotten too fussy about things, right?
That's right.
But what is the matter with liking certain things in certain ways? I don't understand your aversion to my behavior. Surely it's not harmful. Come on, Joe, loosen up.
Well, you feel I have violated you. But actually, I'm setting you free. I am loosening you up. particularity leads to peculiarity, and then to pathological behaviour. The three P's. It's very insidious. You would eventually end up in a box. If you try to control your environment, it will soon control you. And everyone else around you will always have to be making adjustments to your maddening idiosyncrasies.
Maybe so, but I still don't think there is any harm in it.
You know the most profound line in the Lord's Prayer? Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
Evil? You're saying my behavior is evil?
Well, we want to be free from desire, do we not?
Yes.
Because it leads to temptation, which leads to evil, which is also slavery. If it weren't slavery, the words deliver us would not be used.
Okay. So?
You're beginning to enslave yourself with your fussiness, and therefore you are in evil.
That is a very big claim, Joe.
Yes. Yes, it is, but I like it. I've shown you how to deliver yourself. Now you'll be free to love, free to be good.
I don't know.
Well, let's take another tack. We deplore attachment, do we not?
Yes.
Because attachment leads to suffering.
Yes.
You are attached to your place at the table and to the blue plate. I forbear thinking of other possible quirks, how you align your books on the shelf, or which of your teeth are the first to be brushed. Possibly the canines.
I guess I see what you're saying.
Well, let me say in conclusion that developing and embracing these peculiarities will make you forget that you are enlightened. You are a holy person.
But I never knew that. I never thought that.
Yes, yes you did. But you forgot. You must live your life in such a way that you will remember.
And what happens when I remember? What do I do then?
Well, then you can forget about it.
There were two people in the line who were as night and day, Jacob and Anna, and they both had secrets. Jacob's secret was eating him up. Anna's was sustaining her. Anna was in her mid-30s from Ireland, a quiet, retiring woman whom everyone in the line was nevertheless drawn to because of her joyousness and peacefulness. They would crowd about her when the line broke for the day, wanting to talk to her or simply be with her. Also, she was a nurse, and amiable about tending any cuts or bruises, or listening to long, sad stories of aches and pains, past and present illnesses. She herself rarely spoke, which made it more amazing that she had such an effect on them all.
Strange to say, sad, or perhaps happy to say, some of us, after spending time with Anna, no longer felt it necessary to wait and see the holy man, and so started home with a buoyant step.
Many of us wondered about her, unable to understand what someone so happy in herself was doing here in the line, but when asked why she needed to see the holy man, she said nothing. This was her secret.
Jacob had the opposite effect on us pilgrims. We didn't shun him exactly. There was something so dark, something so seemingly dangerous about him that we kept our distance. He was a large, muscular man in middle age, a European with a chiselled, bony, clenched face that looked like it might fall off if he tried to smile.
I didn't care that they kept apart from me. My job was to see the holy man, tell him my secret, and that was it. If relief came with the telling of it, maybe I would take on life again. If not, I would put an end to my life. Over and out.
Anna was not far ahead of Jacob in the line, and he was aware of her popularity. He was interested that this small, quiet, unglamorous woman could generate such enthusiasm, but he was not jealous. He had never cared whether people liked him or not. Geniality was not his strong suit. They admired and respected him. Some possibly feared him. He had a few genuinely close friends, and there were women who had passionately loved him for a time.
If anything, this Anna is happy because she is a fool. She knows nothing of the dark underbelly of life, where the maggots are.
But it was hard to maintain this fiction after spending 2 minutes with a woman, or the 1 second it took to feel her glance looking straight into his heart and not shrinking from what she saw there, not forgiving him, but, as he saw it, allowing him.
As the days passed, I found myself observing her more and more closely, subsequently wanting to be near her, and when I was near her, feeling willing to make myself attractive to her. I began to think that if I had such a woman in my life, someone so good as Anna loving me, then everything would be all right. It was that simple. My depression, which seemed unconquerable, could be abated in a minute if I could have her for my own. Like drinking a magic potion. Imagine. Oh, when I came home at night, her face would light up to see me, and my heart would fill with gladness. All this black despair that weighs me down, it would be cast away.
He had the insight to ask himself why a face already so alight would light up to see such a one as he, but he brushed the question aside. He asked himself why such a treasure would love a brute like himself.
But I am partly good brute. I've shared my wealth with the needy. I've helped young men on in their careers, been a loving father to my sons, despite the toll of my divorces. Anna would bring out the good that's in me. That makes me feel so much better. And in return for her love and peace and boundless good humor, I would do many nice things for her. Reward her with clothes, jewels, travels, and houses in different lands. All the things women so loved. And since she is younger and will want children, I'll be happy to provide.
So Jacob lived in his fantasy and was seen to almost smile successfully and be charming on occasion, and the pilgrims felt a little bit more comfortable around him. Until the night he joined Anna's circle, carrying sticks he had gone far afield to gather for her fire, and he heard her speak of her husband and children. It was not the flaring fire that caused the red-hot heat to charge to his face, but a mixture of rage and shame. He turned abruptly and disappeared into the surrounding darkness.
What right has she to be in this line alone for all this long time, portraying herself as a single available woman? She has lured me on, given me hope, being profligate with her smiles and warm gestures, wooed me with her gentle ways. Whenever she looked at me, I'd felt so alive, so important, as if I had a right, after all, to be on this earth. I believed she cared for me. But she didn't. She's made a fool of me. Now I hate myself even more.
When he cooled down, he admitted to himself that he, not she, had been the deluder. And she did care for him, exactly as much as she cared for the others. The real delusion had been his belief in an instant magic potion cure, the idea that someone else could make him better.
Are you all right?
No.
Tomorrow we'll see the holy man.
It won't help.
Maybe not, but you'll see him, and then... who knows?
Jacob felt a wave of utter hopelessness. At the same time, in the darkness, He felt the muscles of his face unclench, his lips fall apart, his brow clear. His face, letting go in this way, allowed the lines of age and sorrow to reveal themselves on his infinitely tired flesh.
At least now you're ready.
Every time Joe opened the door to a pilgrim, with his eyes full of welcome, a smile on his lips, he was hoping it would be the one he was waiting for. Not the one or two or three who might spend the winter with him, but the one to whom he hoped to pass on his teachings, who would take his place when he died, spreading the word of the inherent holiness of people and nature, the need for kindliness and learning. Many wonderful people had come his way. Many had become monks and part of his community.
But none of them was the person I had in mind. I never doubted he or she would come. But now many years had gone by without the appearance of the person I longed for, and I felt that my days were winding down. He or she had better hurry. But one day, I opened the door, and there she stood, a woman in her middle 30s, with short, straight, red hair, brown eyes, an air of absolute balance and possession, a look that was at once grave and happy. We fell into each other's arms like long-lost friends, and for a confused minute I thought, no, this isn't the one. It's my dearest daughter returned to me.
When Joe was a young man, both his wife and daughter were killed in a terrible accident. He had to give them back.
I have been looking all over for you.
I have been waiting for you.
They talked together for an hour. Mostly Joe listened. It emerged Anna had been dreaming about him for years.
The face in the dream was clearly yours, now that I see you. But as there was no picture of you anywhere in the world, there was nothing I could match my dream face to. Oh, I looked. I went to see the different holy men who came to my country, and I read all I could about the ones who existed in remote parts of the world. When I heard about you, I felt you were the one. But it was so hard for me to get away.
What is your situation?
I'm a nurse. I'm married, and we have two children. I've been saving money for years, but then I was put in charge of the clinic where I worked. But finally, the day came when I'd arranged childcare for the children, a replacement of work, and I could begin the journey here. My husband, friends and colleagues all think me quite mad and are rather angry with me, to tell the truth. But now it has taken so long to get to your door that I am overdue home. I was hoping I might stay for a while, but it is impossible. I'm sorry.
Oh, dear. I'm sorry, too.
But I'm so glad I came. My experience in the line among the pilgrims was unforgettable. And then to meet you at last, spend this hour with you, is like being reunited with an identical twin. I feel so moved by our connection.
So I told her about my work, about the hermitage life, how I tried to teach people to honour each other, strive toward excellence in one's own life, no matter how insignificant one's work. To live fully, fearlessly, dedicated to learning and kindliness, enemies of anger and greed. You're welcome to stay as long as you can, but I do understand your predicament.
I can't stay.
Oh, dear. I don't understand. Why has she been given to me at last? Only to be snatched away.
What do you think it meant, my having this ongoing dream of you? Isn't it strange? I know you don't need me in any way, but, well, can I do anything for you before I go? Are you feeling all right? I am a nurse, after all.
I was overcome. I found I couldn't tell her who she was and what she meant to me.
I'm feeling fine, Anna. I understand the calls of your family and job. I'm not sure what the dreams mean. It is wonderful that you surmounted such difficulties to come all this way. I am profoundly happy to know that you are here in the world.
When they parted, they embraced again, and Anna wept.
I have to confess that I don't want to go. I don't want to leave you. I feel I am making a big mistake. But God, I'm so torn.
I was on the tip of my tongue to ask her outright to stay, or else at least to go home and consider a return. Go home and settle her affairs for a final return, so that I might pass down the mantle of my wisdom. But the words wouldn't come. Refused to leap from my tongue to the air between us. I didn't want to seem to beseech her. I felt the decision must be entirely hers. And deep in my heart, I also felt that the work she was doing was perhaps more important than being with me.
And so Anna went away. Joe watched until she was out of sight. The one he'd waited for all these years. He felt a sob rise up in his breast, and he let it come, let the tears come, and for a few minutes, all his wisdom could not help him deal with this mighty disappointment.
Then I recovered and remembered my own words, that I am happy she is here in the world. She would find her way without me, even if she didn't get to teach thousands as I have. Still, every person who passed through her life would be touched by her holiness, and there would be a ripple effect. I could have asked her to stay. Jesus called his apostles away, saying, "Follow me." And that was that. They dropped everything. Family, work, everything, and came. Gautama Buddha left his spouse and children. So why couldn't I ask Anna to do so? Well, I couldn't. I am me, not them. It didn't feel right. It would have been bad action.
After seeing Anna off, Joe felt he could not go on receiving that day. He would do better to close up shop. However, after spending an hour alone, he recovered his balance and decided to press on. The season was almost over, and there were still so many in the line. He had about a dozen visitors, and then Jacob came to the door.
Good afternoon, holy man. My name is Jacob.
Do sit down. Tell me your story.
When I was a teenager, I left my home in the European Alps, and I set out to wander the world, taking odd jobs as I went. I was curious about other countries.
I, too, spent years of wandering, but I was older than you when I set out, in my 30s. I was not so much curious as lost and despairing.
One night when I was 17 years old, I found myself in a French port, in a bar, having a wild time with some other young fellows. And it struck me that traveling wasn't enough. I needed a far grander experience, something with danger and drama. And so I joined the French Foreign Legion for a period of 4 years.
Go on.
I was determined to be a first-rate soldier, one of the elite. I was sent to Vietnam. This was before America entered the war. I fought the Viet Cong and the Khmer Rouge. I was trained by a superb officer how to move quietly through the jungle, how to kill quietly my worthy opponents with a knife or with bare hands. I was very good. This went on for 3 years. I became a lieutenant. Remarkably, I wasn't seriously injured. A few knife wounds.
You were lucky.
Yeah. Then the Legion decided to pull me out and send me to Algeria. When my men and I were leaving the plane and heading for the terminal, I was shot in the back. I was sent to a hospital in Paris, and I was told I didn't need to serve my last year. I stayed around Paris until my wound healed completely, and then I went home. Everyone at home thought that I had been traveling the world. I didn't want them to know the truth. I was no longer the boy who'd gone off in a search of excitement. Although I thought myself a fine, brave fellow. The only person I told was my mother, and she said she didn't want a killer in her home. Yeah. This was very deflating, but it was true. Maybe if I had been defending my own country, it would have been different, but I was a mercenary. I and some of my buddies had already been approached by different foreign powers for the high-paying job of assassin. I put that period of my life out of my mind as if it never existed. I was only 20. I went back to school, I got a business degree, and I opened a store. A very tame life. The shop did well, became a chain of stores, and I was rich. I married and had 3 boys.
And did you tell your wife and children?
No. No, I had taken my mother's reaction to heart. I couldn't ask a wife to understand the cruelty and bestiality I engaged in. Even if you have been to war, you can't. Maybe there is nothing to understand, because it is so senseless. And my boys, they would have admired me more, like a movie star action hero. I could not abide that.
It is fair enough.
But I have had